The sun hung within a few degrees of the hills behind Calcutta. After the last of our food and equipment had been lowered into the hold and stowed securely, the mate, a blocky red-faced man of 40 with the auspicious name of Salvatore Soterio, assembled the crew on the deck before the wheelhouse. Randall sat on the capstan, arms folded, a roll of Lisbou parasol under one arm. The sunset cast ship, crew, docks, and warehouses in a fiery glow. Black dust from the Silvas, blown far out to sea from the continent, made for spectacular day's-end colors. Waiting for the captain, I stood among the apprentices and ABs, who, shuffling their feet, those who knew each other murmuring and exchanging knowing glances, ignored me but for sidling glances and occasional gruff instructions, one of them being to "Watch his way, watch your way, learn and be meshed," by which they meant follow the example of experienced crew members and fit into the way of the ship. The mate called us to respectful attention. The captain emerged from his quarters and gazed at the setting sun with a squint as if he were some bug emerging from under a rock. He came to the rail and swept his eyes over the crew on the quarterdeck. "We've received our orders and confirmed our mission," Kaiser Bach began. "With first light tomorrow, we put out to sea. Most of you are new to the Vigilant, new to me and the Master as well. You've signed on from Tasman grain ships and merchant vessels and a few from pleasure boats, and you should know the Vigilant runs a different course. We are out for learning, not for trade. We will circumnavigate for the glory of knowledge. We'll chart the life of Lamarckia in its most extreme forms. It's been tried before. Two missions, four ships. Two of them sunk, fate be kind, and the winds rest above them. There are hazards enough where we'll go, some known, some not. We are as infants on the face of Lamarckia. I've spent 20 years on these seas, and still know them only poorly. And half the world has yet to be seen at all. This voyage depends on all of us to keep our senses sharp. Because what is taught in Lenk schools, even in secondary, is so tentative and inadequate, I feel it is my duty to train you all to a finer sense of nature. That makes this as much a school ship as a research and exploration vessel. Some of you will think me eccentric, and if my eccentricities spread rumor along the dock and make me a laughing stock, so be it. So now all of you know my style. Fairness follows performance. We'll all make history, if we mind our weather and keep eyes bright and straight ahead." The gloom of the past few days was lifting. I glanced at the crew around me, at Randall. The master's face seemed to take on a new light, his weariness fading. They truly were in their early age of exploration here, hazards enough for any adventurer. I looked on the Vigilant, with all her eccentricities and inadequacies, with blossoming affection. I was the last of the new crew. The navigator and provisions mate, French, whom I had met earlier, wrote me into the crew list and the supplies roster, gave me a thick oiled canvas coat and pants, a pair of boots more appropriate to shipboard duties, and took me to my assigned berth in the forecastle. Thick-jawed, pouch-cheeked, with enormous shoulders and unforgiving black eyes, Soterio, the mate, called the crew together before sunset on the foredeck. Randall watched with little apparent interest, leaning on the starboard rail. I took my place with the apprentices, scrawny fellows, little more than gangling, uneasy boys. "Good evening," Soterio said, forcing what could be mistaken for an amiable smile. "Good evening," we murmured.
"It looks to be a glorious one, too," he said, his face betraying no great enthusiasm. "I'll leave talk about pride and accomplishment to the master and the captain. I'm practical, myself, and care only for my life, my ship, and my crew, in whatever order you find most comforting." He huffed out his cheeks, shook his head. "But there's rules we lay down here and now."
He paced before us, thick arms crossed over his chest, jaw thrust forward.
"What the master tells me, I tell you, and you do. No flarking, no stumping about, nothing lax. Flark and I'm on ya. There's no ship on this world that runs herself, and none so complicated a fool can't learn her. But learn we must. He huffed again. This is no yacht. So put your days at Link School or wherever behind you. The great Darwin is no lake. It's a sea, foaming and thick, as unforgiving as any sailed by man or woman on any world. He glared at us through those cold black marbles. Yes, sir, we responded. And when the voyage begins, none of this sir stuff. It's the sir of many sea-going centuries, and not for politesse. Yes, sir. Some have sailed before, some a lot, most not. Some have sailed under the master and me. But all will follow me around the deck this evening and learn this ship and her ways. Soterio then took us around the boat, stem to stern, talking rapidly for an hour. All that I had studied of ships and seamanship for this mission only began to prepare me for the shift of language, for the invention of the immigrants. Many sailing terms used by the mate were familiar, but the immigrants had built their ships without benefit of years at sea, using only what references they found in the slates they had brought with them. There were differences, and mixtures of nautical terms across the centuries. The Vigilant was three-masted, full-rigged by old Earth standards, yet here she was called a spankered three-tree. The masts, in the mate's lingo, were all trees, and he named them fore-tree, main-tree, and mizzen. The names of the major sails were easy enough to adjust to, the lowermost called courses and named after their trees, fore-course, main-course, but then on the mizzen, the Christian, called crowjack or crossjack traditionally. The next pair, gallant and top-gallant. Above them, upper and lower topsails became high-top and low-top. But the jibs, from bowsprit and jib-boom to foremast, were called bellies. The outermost called, without a single smile among the apprentices, the flying belly. The seldom-used royals above the high-tops took the name skysails. Stays supporting the masts remained stays, and the sails, sometimes hung from them, staysails. Studding sails, however, were called wings, bent or fastened to extensions of the yards called outbrooms. "So it is," the mate said. "When the Vigilant's going to sweep with the wind up her ass, we beat with our wings, bellies in the breeze, clear?" He dared anyone to smile. The halyards, braces, sheets, and other rigging working all these reflected such changes. I labored to memorize, and to forget some of what I had learned on the Lake of the Winds. Fortunately, on the upper decks and below decks, the names had changed little. Fore and aft still applied, bow, midships, stern, forecastle, foredeck or main deck, quarterdeck aft of the main tree. But the poop aft of the mizzen had reverted to the original Latin, pupis. The long superstructure on the pupis, which appeared top-heavy to me, was called with affection the pup-castle. On the Vigilant, the captain, master, doctor, and researchers kept quarters here, and the two laboratories were also in the pup-castle. The ship's craft rates, Story Meisner, the dark sepulchral sailmaker, the small, dour female carpenter, Varia Guzmao, William French, the navigator, stooped, grizzled, and wrinkled Pyotr Kovansk, the engineer, and Shatro, the only researcher already on board, bunked in the pup castle as well, sharing a common cabin, or adjacent to their work cabins. The able-bodied seamen, or ABs, and apprentices, sometimes called monkeys, since they spent much of their time in the trees, were each allotted a bunk in the forecastle. All below the craft rates served watches, 4 hours on and 4 hours off, divided into port and starboard. Each craft rate and AB and apprentice received 3 meals a day. Grain from Jakarta and Tasman provided the staple, supplemented by flockweed flour. The mainstay was free chunk, a paste made of soy and flockweed, served up fried or baked, or ground into flour and made into bread. Packed and dried river celery and diasporos served for essential vitamins. Fresh terrestrial fruits and vegetables grown on plantations outside Calcutta served as treats.
Sailors, it seemed, did not favor scion fruits such as Liz cherries, and sea-going or pelagic scions, whatever ecos they came from, were by and large inedible, unlike their riparian counterparts, which could at times be nutritious and not provoke immune challenges. There were plans, Sotério told us darkly, to feed the crew occasionally on land scions deemed edible by the cook, with the second opinion of the captain and the chief researcher, the mate added. This was obviously something of a sore point with the more experienced crew, since nearly all, according to whispers, had eaten one or another type of non-Liz scion that had not agreed with them. The tour finished with a brief lecture from Sotério on discipline.
Each is expected to do his work. Favoritism of any sort is considered flarking.
The mate used the word flarking constantly to describe anything in opposition to the ship's established order. Now his brows almost obscured his black marble eyes, and he crooked his mouth as if remembering a bitter taste.
There is to be no sex between crew members at sea.
No need to explain why.
We are all equally valuable here, and such leads to serious disputes. Phylactics, meaning drugs to dampen sexual drive, an interesting misuse of a word, are available from the medical.
The mate concluded this lecture with a list of punishments.
First-time offense, 4 hours at the skysail top. Second, confinement in store's antechamber for a time deemed sufficient by the captain and master. Third, we put you off at the next settlement landfall and take aboard someone more suited.
The crew was then sent to arrange their personal effects. There would be no dinner served aboard this evening. Instead, the crew could spend their last night in town. In the forecastle, all had been assigned their bunks by number, but the ABs, quietly and with little resistance, traded assignments with the others for a section of their own. The social weaving took perhaps 10 minutes, with the apprentices left a step behind somewhat bewildered. Talia Rai Diem, the senior female AB, a grizzled, stocky woman with thick, well-muscled arms and legs and a bulldog countenance, took it upon herself to explain.
There's rates, and there's ranks, even on a free citizen's ship. More experience, more time at sea, more privileges. The ABs know enough to keep you from killing yourselves. It's only right. And what's more, it puts me in a better bunk.
A curtain was drawn, forming a partition for the 12 women. All the women were ABs, and they commandeered a portion of the elite section and put an angle in the curtain to mark their special territory. As there were no female apprentices, we could divide no farther and receive the least desirable berths, with so little difference between them that arguing was useless. Names were exchanged again for the benefit of the newer crew members. I shook hands with my shipmates, a pot of Tasman tea was set boiling, and sweet biscuits passed around from Rai Diem's chest.
These are especially for the new ones, who don't know how this kind of ship works, Rai Diem said. We all have to get along in a special way, a sea-going way that works across months or years without much in the way of fighting. If you have any questions or problems, you can come to me or to Ser Shankara. Or to Meissner, the sailmaker. He's a good man. He and I have sailed before.
The apprentices, after trying to brighten the picture of being closest to the bow, in the tightest spaces and with the smallest bunks, set to displaying and describing their few valued possessions that all would know who might have stolen from whom. Already 2 likely characters had been singled out as potential thieves, the youngest and scrawniest, both with narrow, lackadaisical faces. Uwe Kisbeg and Uri Ridgel, who seemed to wear perpetual smiles of shocked innocence. A tall boy of 18 with a thick shock of brown hair, shaven thin at the sides, shook my hand with extra conviction.
My name's Algis Bas Shimchisko. My first ship. Yours too?
I smiled and nodded.
Apprentices have to stick together, Shimchisko said. The AB's lorded if we don't. From Calcutta?
Jakarta, I said.
Meet Mishta Ebert,
Shimchisko said, putting his arm around the wide shoulders of a thin boy of 16 or 17, with a small mouse-like face and short fox-fur hair. Ebert smiled.
We joined together. We've both taken science at the Lenk schools. We spent 5 months in the depths of Liz,
inland from Cape Zuritis, Ebert said. We think we know Liz very well.
What does she think of you? I asked. The boys laughed loudly. Shimchisko slapped his knee.
We think she favors us, of course. All the women do.
Among the other faces, I paid immediate attention to Ellis Shankara, senior male AB. A quiet, dark-skinned man with humored eyes, large and examining, but a stern mouth. Shankara's alert expression and calm manner impressed me. I spent a few minutes watching a short-legged, round-faced woman AB with a quick, bird-like manner, whom I found oddly attractive, but whose name I did not then catch. Kisbeg and Ridgel took it upon themselves to play an ill-timed jape as we put our valuables away in shallow drawers beside the bunks. Kisbeg leaped about in seeming abandon, claiming to perform a farewell dance to the land. Ridgel tootled him along with a raucous lip warble, and as if by accident, Kisbeg swooped down upon and fell through the curtain separating our bow space from the space set aside for the female ABs. Hair on end like a furious cat, Talia Rydiam yanked Kisbeg up with two strong hands around his jaw and ears and dragged him until she jammed him against the forward fiber locker.
"I'm kind," she growled, "but I'll kick your ass if you don't act the man."
Saying not another word, glaring fiercely, she left him there minus his smile. I liked all of this. It seemed very alive and boisterous. I might slip smoothly into the immigrant culture after all. Despite my earlier misgivings, and whatever their skills and however isolated, these people seemed at heart decent and hard-working. They wished to learn what they could, and they were willing to take obvious risks to do so. I could cheerfully go to sea with these people, work with them, learn what I could. I could even forget for a time what my mission was. Before all introductions could be finished, with the crew's opinions of each other given an early shape, the mate returned.
"You'll stare at every block and line for the next few years," he chided. "Grab the shore for one more night."
All but one of the women chose to stay aboard, boiling their own free chunk over a small stove, stringing mat fiber ropes to air their clothes. Most of the male ABs and apprentices and several of the ranks left the Vigilant just before sundown and took the hill step road up and over a low rise to that part of Calcutta where all sailors were supposed to go. The nightlife of Calcutta had been walled off, concentrated, and capped in a district of town away from the center, surrounded by high stone walls, a dreary, river-damp set of narrow streets and low ramshackle buildings the color of dust and cloudy sky. Here the cobbles had gaping holes. I saw a suspicious congeries of holes before an empty building with broken windows, a broken sign over the door reading ADVE, and the gutters had not been swept. It smelled anciently human, yet seemed quiet. The crews of several vessels wandered these few streets, mostly male. Without the women, the men became restless, peering into windows, making dull, unenthusiastic remarks, trying out their sailors' gaits, broad steps and arms swinging confidently, coming upon each other every third turn, looking for cheer and something to brace up their spirits for the coming absence from shore. Little cheer or support was to be found. A brief flame of sunset turned our faces and the low, false-fronted buildings orange. Dusk followed quickly, gray and dismal. The fitful lighting, dim lamps on xylopoles at corners, made us all shadows. Three scattered knots of searchers, 20 in all, 8 from the Vigilant, including Shimchisko and Ebert, the eldest among us, Shankara, and the round-faced young female apprentice, Shift or Shirla, went from a small bar with 5 stools and 2 tables serving bitter rum to a larger establishment reputed to serve food, to the largest place of all, which the most experienced men seemed to avoid with dark faces. But this, the walk-in known as the Fishless Sea, was where we ended up. Here was entertainment, the most perverse and therefore fatally attractive that the Devaricate city could offer. Here a half-dozen blank-faced women and a few pale men offered themselves for conversation or dancing or turns in the rooms upstairs. It was fairly ritualized and acceptable. Devaricates had never been prudes, But something else hung in the air of the fishless sea, a restless, guilty anticipation made half of dread and half of curiosity. The best entertainment in this establishment, the older hand said, was supplied by Lamarckia itself. Shankara led us through thick xyla doors, into cool air, a small dark room at the very rear, the sounds of the kitchen coming from someplace to my left. The rum buzzed in me, a novel and not unpleasant sensation. I sat with my shipmates before a low stage daubed with tarry black paint. A short, slender woman with long brown hair and a fixed gaze, who some said was the owner, came on stage and stood beneath a bright spot. Her voice was deep and sandy, and she did not look at her audience. Some chewed mat fiber, tasteless but scented of sweetness and garlic and filled with a mild stimulant, and others drank more rum. The young, round-faced female A.B. sat beside Shankara and balanced a plate of indifferent gruel on her lap, eating slowly, staring up with doubtful but wide eyes. "We've all lived our lives in the shadow of the Silva," the woman said in a breathless monotone. "We've been sampled and the Silva knows us. But can we ever know the Silva? There are curiosities, peculiarities. The zones, rich with life, do they resent us? Do they notice our existence? Can they truly see and think, or are they blind as stones? Sometimes we feel we are wrapped in the depths of a heedless mother, and we cry out in our sleep like children. There are mysteries no one will ever fathom. Absurd mysteries, unexplainable phenomena. How many have heard stories?" A few hands rose, then others, taking encouragement in numbers. "I've heard stories," the woman continued, nodding to herself, her tone confessional and then darkly mysterious. "Stories not to be believed. Terrifying, strange, but not surprising. Does anything surprise us on this, our chosen world?" An edge of weary resentment in her words now, eyebrow raised, a flip of the long brown hair. I sat with my hands gripping the sides of the seat of my chair. A fog of unreality stole over me, caused not by the rum, but by the sour animal smell of bodies in the close room, the rough lisbu between my fingers, the floor strewn with bits of dried parasol leaf to soak up spilled liquid. The cloying smell of mat drifted through the air, sweet and garlicky. "When my husband vanished in eastern Tasman, hunting curiosities in Baker's Zone, I took off to search for him. Long weeks and months by boat, then through thick swamp, over tall mountains." "Get on with it," grumbled the bearded man near me, swaying slightly in his chair, jaw working on a clump of mat. "To find something." "Something," the crowd shouted in derision. "Show us." "Not pickled," the woman said, leaning toward the crowd, hands sweeping out, fingers pointing, enjoying her own melodrama. "Not stuck in a bottle."
"Not like us,"
a man shouted, and the crowd laughed at itself in a perverse humor. "Not in a bottle. Alive. Alive and away from its land, and so very lonely," she chanted.
"Like us," several voices sang out, nervous laughter now.
"Strange," the woman said, "to stare into what it uses for its eyes and wonder, does it think? Does it miss its home thousands of kilometers away? Does it miss its queen, whom no one has ever seen? Was I cruel to bring it here? Was I seeking to avenge my husband?"
"Be cruel! Be cruel!"
a drunken man, not of our ship, shouted from the front. This is the dream. Link's dream, I thought. Get his people away from Thistledown, from people no longer shaped like people, from the blasphemous way. The rum fogged and distorted and was no longer pleasant. I set my glass down, half empty, and drank no more. Two brawny men in aprons rolled a large crate onto the stage. Liquid slopped from between the boards and ran thick and brown over the black tarry floor, lapping up against the raised edge of the fiddle, I thought, testing out a nautical term, like old port spilled on a ship's table. Within the crate, a sigh, a clatter of sticks or branches. "What possible use to its zone, to its queen?" the woman asked dreamily. "Such a monster? Perhaps no use at all. A sport, a dream gone bad, a nightmare. The silver dreams and twitches in its sleep. We hear it, breathing its black breath across the land, over our heads, in our skin and hair. We cut its trees, harvest its leaves, fence its helpers and attendants. Will it not some day know what we are and hate us? What will it make next? Perhaps this is a test, something that will eventually grow large and attack. Let's take a look and perhaps see our future."
"Nah," a man sneered from the rear of the room, waving a hand. He stood and pushed through the thick Xyla door. The woman on stage watched him leave with sad, tired eyes. The cool air settled again. The woman reached out for the crate, challenging the audience with a piercing stare. Her hands fumbled at a corroded brass latch, opened the front of the crate wide with a groaning creak. One of the burly men stood beside a stage light and dropped a colored gel over the bulb. The stage became green, dark and cold.
"From the north," the woman moaned as if mourning. "It might have killed my husband. It wants to kill me and go home. A monster, a queen's own nightmare. Look upon it."
The door swung all the way, and within, restrained by iron bars, a cage within the crate, long, thin black legs, dozens of them, with red joints. The round-faced woman leaned forward, eyes even wider. The audience fell silent. A chair leg racketed on the floor, several feet shuffled.
"Fate and Numa," said one voice.
"Hoping to kill us all," the woman on stage suggested dreamily.
Lights switched on overhead, bathing the cage in brighter green and yellow. The form in the cage stirred, legs twitching. The woman pulled a large key on a brass ring from the folds of her dress, slipped it into a prominent lock on the cage within the crate, turned the key, and pulled open the cage door with a ghastly, unoiled screech. The sailors in the first row of the theater pushed their chairs back with a clatter until outthrust arms and legs from the people behind would let them push no farther.
"What would we do if they freely walked among us?" the woman asked, spinning out her story, making herself a potential victim as the legs stretched reflexively across the stage toward her, flat cup-claw feet spatting into the leaking brown liquid.
One sailor, a young fellow not from the Vigilant, bolted. Shankara looked after him and gave me a knowing smile. The creature squeezed and squirmed slowly from its cage and stood in the sickly light, rising 3 meters in height, gangly, loose. I tried to discern its shape in the glare. Thick trunk or abdomen dragging, thin upper body, discs half-rotating at its shoulders and emerging from the edges of the discs, the long, half-limp legs. It had no head, but a long stalk pushed up from the trunk and arched over the form, and from this hung two transparent globes, eyes perhaps, that slowly rotated, black oblate pupils absorbing the sight of the crowd. It sighed, thorax expanding alarmingly, then shivered its legs together. The audience as one groaned and backed away, tables and chairs bunching, overturning. The scion and the woman seemed to regard each other with equal detachment.
"What is it you wish, monster?" the woman asked coldly.
The form lifted its legs as if beckoning.
"Me?" the woman asked, voice rising to a kind of cheery glee. "Me? As well as my husband? Stop it!"
shouted the man half-seated in front of me, For the love of God, it's just a scion, a sylvan child. Let it be.
The woman ignored him. The audience had come here for rough entertainment. She was determined to give it to them. The long pleats of her dress contained many things, apparently. She lowered one hand gracefully and brought out a machete.
"Which is it to be?" she asked us. "Revenge or forgiveness? Respect or anger given an edge?"
My own anger suddenly flared, and I restrained myself with an effort. The woman's face fairly glowed with enthusiasm. She seemed half committed to chopping the form to bits. In the cloud of rum, I thought, no act, this. But the burly men emerged from the wings and restrained her, one grabbing the arm with the machete, both bodily lifting her, suddenly rigid as a board. The slow, spidery creature, left alone on the stage, sighed, bunched its legs up, and sidled back into its cage. The stagehands returned without the woman, and raised and locked the door of the crate, then lowered the curtains. The audience sat stunned for a moment. That was all? No exit music, no announcements? Grumbling, disheartened, we passed through the glass doors to the bar. I stayed behind, stunned and heartsick, slumped in my chair. Somehow, this seemed almost as wrong and perverse as the slaughter at moonrise. The round-faced woman, Shift or Shirla, put aside her unfinished bowl of gruel and stood before the stage and curtains. She wore a kerchief around her head, topped with a small black hat. Her face seemed childlike in the half-light. She turned to Shankara. "What is it?" she asked.
"Nothing but a Tasman Western scion," Shankara said, half in contempt, half in pity. "Not Eastern. Not from Baker. Probably from Kandinsky's zone. But I'm just guessing."
"We'll see more like that?" the woman asked distantly. Shankara gave a brief hollow laugh and looked at me with dark brown eyes.
"Shocking, eh? We live in the most boring zone on Lamarckia. We have to import our monsters."
"It was wonderful," the round-faced woman said, and seemed genuinely to mean it. "Poor thing. What does it do?"
"A mulcher, I'd guess," he said. "Something that cleans arborid roots and prepares soil. About as dangerous as a cricket. I've served on merchant ships going to Tasman and seen stranger than that."
We walked toward the door past the small tables and overturned chairs.
"Your name is Olmi, isn't it?" Shankara said.
"Yes," I said. I looked at the young-faced woman. Her eyes flicked to meet mine like a bird's.
"This is Shirla," Shankara said.
"Shirla Apnam," the woman added. "Junior A.B." She picked something from her teeth with one finger and shook her head as we pushed through the heavy doors.
"You know," she said, "if we had a zoo or something." "The captain has a zoo," Shankara said. "A small one, in bottles."
"Not what I mean," Shirla said.
"If we could go see all the parts, all the scions, we wouldn't act like such damn fools."
By midnight, beneath a cloudless sky filled with the double arc of stars and one small lantern-bright moon, the crews wended their way back to the docks and ships, neither wholly drunk nor satisfied. I walked a few meters behind Shankara and Shirla and the rest of the group from the Vigilant. Shirla kept glancing over her shoulder at me as if I might be stalking her. With her last glance, she gave a little shiver and frowned in apparent disapproval. Somehow this completed my sadness. As they rounded a corner ahead of me, a man stepped from the shadows and held up an arm. I gave him a wide berth by instinct, but the man spoke my name. It was the disciplinary Thomas. He wore a dull green overcoat and a small cloth cap with a tail that fell down his neck into his collar.
"I had hoped you would stick around long enough to answer my questions. Now you'll put out to sea, on a research ship, no less."
"Is that suspicious?" I asked. I stuck my hands in my pockets. "I'm interested in the zones. I always have been." Thomas looked at me with a bland, patient expression.
"I've had time enough to run my checks. No birth records for an Olmi of the Dachetong. No Lenk school or residence records. Unless you come from Shia or some unregistered community, you don't exist.
I felt distinctly uncomfortable. Then I took a chance. Sir Thomas, nobody has complete records anymore. I stood in the dark beside Thomas, and silence fell between us for several seconds. Finally, he looked away, then down at the stone paving.
I don't believe you're a Brianist. That doesn't make sense, judging from your behavior and how we met. You would have faded into the Silva and taken a passenger boat later, or made your own. I've given a lot of thought to you. I think perhaps I will leave you alone and let you go where you wish.
Thank you, I said.
There was a small group of people years ago that kept a secret vigil. They called themselves Adventists. They were waiting for someone from the Hexamon to arrive.
Sounds Christian, I said.
Advent means the coming of something big, something momentous, nothing to do with Christians. Not all of them made their views known. One of them stole something and vanished. Nobody knows the details except perhaps Link himself. I had heard there was an Adventist in Moonrise.
Was there?
I don't know, I said.
Is it a crazy idea?
Why didn't they come years ago? I asked.
Thomas smiled. Now that I don't know either. Some say we erased the path to Lamarckia and we'll be here forever, alone.
Suits me, I said.
Thomas's bland expression returned.
If they did come, they would try to take us all back to the Way. That's the general opinion. I'm not so sure now that we've been here so long and we've grown in numbers. We own this world as much as any human owns anything.
We don't own the zones, I said, trying to reestablish some fragment of my role.
No, Thomas said thoughtfully.
Promise me this, will you? Someday, if there's time, and if you can, unravel a few mysteries for me.
I shook my head, grinned, looked away as if to say crazy notions.
Thomas raised his hands, clasped them, and rubbed his palms together.
The citizens' rank made their decision earlier this evening. Brianists or their renegades killed the citizens at Moonrise. Naderville will claim it was renegades. It's for the rank at Athenae to decide what to do. No need for more testimony from you. You're free to go wherever you please.
With a curt nod, Thomas turned and walked up the street, past a feeble street lamp and into shadows.
Calcutta was a dull town indeed, I thought to myself as I walked up the gangway to the Vigilant, at least as far as its vices were concerned. The Varicates had no flair for debauchery. I was eager to get to sea.
I stood sleepless by the taffrail, staring astern at the cold black waters and the night, half-clouded, the void between black clouds thick-studded with stars. I thought about Lamarckia's sun and her five sister planets, about which I found very little in Red Hill other than what the original surveyors had recorded. A remarkable lapse on the immigrants' part, or an oversight on Red Hill's, I thought. What I could see between the clouds by eye alone was tantalizing. Just a few degrees east of the main skysail yard shone one very bright bluish point, surrounded by smaller points just outside its concentrated light. Pacifica, a gas giant with many moons that seemed to move as the minutes passed. High above the western horizon gleamed a yellowish point that I was fairly sure must be another planet, probably Aurum. All around shimmered the volumes and volumes of stars, including the double oxbow, part of the encompassing galaxy, analogous to the Milky Way seen from Earth. Randall's few books on astronomy called this blurred twin loop by several names, the Hills, the Kraken, or the Tetons. No astronomical authorities had authorized the final name, apparently. I preferred the Tetons myself. I hoped to find out more by examining the ship's chart room. I left my mates in their bunks in the forecastle when all seemed to sleep soundly. William French, the navigator, was snoring in his pupcastle cabin. The contents of the deserted chart room, books and maps opened or drawn down quietly, lighted only by a single dim lantern, added much to what I needed to know about the immigrants' present state of knowledge. There were no complete and accurate charts of Lamarckia. No one had ever seen the planet from space. No satellites had ever been put into orbit, and the immigrants had much left to explore, including the entire hemisphere opposite Elizabeth's land, called the Deep West by some cartographers, the Far East by others. The star charts were fairly thorough, and some improvements had been made by the immigrants on the surveyor's originals. Ephemeris data was kept in several thick volumes in the chart room, much amended by French's hand, and probably on the captain's slate as well. Naquanos had no such data. The sailors on Lamarckia did not lack knowledge of how to find their way around, and how to calculate latitudes and longitudes. Working with the planet's magnetic field was relatively simple. There were few compass deviations in this hemisphere, and those well understood. Still, any sailor on Earth at the time of Thistledown's launch, or even by the close of the 20th century, would have been appalled at the prospect of using such limited and inaccurate means. What little of Lamarckia had been charted in detail had been explored by brave men and women indeed. Lenk's first captain of voyages, Alphonse Jittermeier, with two sailing ships, had set off from new-founded Calcutta 5 years after the immigrants' arrival. His 2-year journey took him along the Sumner Coast, named after his first mate, to the northeast point of Elizabeth's land, then south, discovering the violently volcanic Agni Islands that lay 400 miles from the continent's eastern coast. Those islands did not figure on later charts. Some of the histories mentioned enormous blasts heard 15 years ago, and clouds of ash settling across southeastern Elizabeth's land, the Darwin Sea, and even Shia. Enormous waves had struck the eastern Cheng Ho coast and Jakarta, causing considerable damage to the human settlement, and the islands were not seen again by merchant ships or later explorers. Penciled on the vigilance charts were specks in that general region and question marks. After leaving these islands, Jittermeier's ships were relentlessly blown south by southwest, back to the southern extremities of Elizabeth's land. Jittermeier and his researchers charted the visible boundaries of what later became known as Zones 5 and 6, Petain and Magellan. They sailed around Cape Magellan, depending in a drawn-up curve from the main body of Elizabeth like a giant fang in the upper jaw of a saber-toothed cat, and found the Coop Islands. Here, a storm sank one boat, and the second, with Jittermeier and 2/3 of both crews, continued south. They found 2 long strips of land, named them the Alishas after the sailor who first sighted them, and then were blown swiftly west to the environs of the southern polar continent, La Perouse Land, seen only as a distant blue coast backed by huge mountains and glaciers. Here they had encountered vicious westerly winds they called the Ice Knives. The winds blew them east along La Perouse Land, the cold, stormy bottom of the world. This ended Jittermeier's plans of circumnavigating Lamarckia. Exhausted, Jittermeier slipped free of the Ice Knives, repaired his ship on southern Alicia, and sailed due north, close-hauled against the seasonal northerlies. Their last discovery, all by chance, was Martha's Island, with its sterile surrounding sea and fertile, varied, lone ecos. Thereafter they turned southwest and put into port at Jakarta. Jittermeier had taken an awful chance. No one knew whether edible scions existed in any of the zones away from Tasman or Elizabeth's land. Indeed, no one was quite sure that the basic biology of these two continents would also be replicated in other territories. Jittermeier's head researcher, Kia Rye Lenk, Jamie Carr Lenk's sister, believed they would find only Ekoi on Lamarckia. Others disagreed. But she had been correct, and no other scheme of life had been discovered. And wherever they went, they found no scions willing to eat them, but sufficient edible forms to sustain the crew. The voyage had been horrific nonetheless. Improper nutritional balances and immune challenges had played havoc with the health of the expedition. In the end, out of 2 ships and 205 men and women, 1 ship and 65 had returned to Jakarta. The sinking of the second ship had drowned many of the crew, including Kia Rye Lenk and her husband and 2 sons. Exploration lost its charm for Abel Lenk. He never quite recovered from the death of his sister. He departed from Jakarta, sailing north to the smaller continent of Tasman, discovered 3 years earlier by merchant ships. There he founded what was now Lamarckia's second-largest city, Athenai. He had not since returned to Jakarta or Calcutta. This had left Elizabeth's land to an uneasy kind of independence. Shortly after, Hoagland and her splinter group had sailed for Shea and founded Godwin, later Naderville. Only one other expedition, led by Dasin Rybaker and Lucius Shulago, had carried on from Jittermeier's example. 25 years after the crossing, they sailed from Jakarta across the Darwin Sea to Shea, then down to the Cook Straits and Cook Islands, between Afraya's Land and Shea. They rounded Afraya's Land, returned to the Darwin Sea, and sailed north until they re-encountered Martha's Island quite by accident. They headed south again, and one ship turned back, carrying all the records from that expedition. On the far side of Shea, in an ocean still almost completely unknown, in search of two small continents rumored to have been seen by merchant ships blown astray, Basilica and Nihon, Baker and Shulago and the second ship vanished after sending a weak radio signal that all was well. Dawn began as a thin pink line against the eastern sky, much of it obscured by the low arborite-crowned hills directly east of Calcutta. The Silva's great four-legged cathedral trees stood against the morning glow like sentinels, feathery fronds below their crowns waving gently with intermittent puffs of breeze that had not yet reached the harbor. The pink horizon turned briefly red, then pale violet. The stars gave way, and the entire sky began to fill with rays of gray and shallow blue. I stretched and swung my arms, working the chill out of my body, then ran around the deck as warm-up, joining French the navigator and three others similarly engaged. The sun stood half above the headland when wake-up was announced by the ringing of a brass bell. Below decks I joined the rest of the crew at the mess. The cook, Leo Frey, a peaceful-looking man of about 40 with a thin body but a prominent belly and fat face, and the cook's sour-looking heavy-set assistant, called simply Passy, dolloped gruel into xyla bowls and handed each of us a thick slice of river celery. Officers shared the same lines and ate the same food, but sat at a separate table in the officers' mess, beyond a narrow open doorway. The rest of the crew, including the navigator, the engineer, the sailmaker, and other craft rates, sat around rough-planed tables in the crew mess in no particular order. The crew went through morning routine in stolid silence, punctuated only by half-awake grunts. When breakfast was finished, in less than 10 minutes, the crew lined up again to drop their bowls into a pot of boiling, frothing water outside the galley. A few minutes attending to personal hygiene, this was a clean ship with a clean crew for which I was grateful, and they all gathered on the upper deck to receive the captain's words, inaugurating the voyage. Captain Kaiser Bach stood on the pubis, looking down on the crew with bright eyes. He stepped to the rail, smiling confidently, and his hands gripped the smoothly turned xyla. "Today we begin our journey to the extremities of this world, and to understand the life upon it. We bow, all of us, to Jittermeier, and to Baker and Shulago, but we will not repeat their mistakes. We add also years more experience on the seas, a better ship, and I am certain, a better crew." He spread his feet wide, balancing from one to the other, clasped his hands, and bowed his head. The crew did likewise. "We set our faith in the lines drawn by star and fate, that all of our worlds here conjoin to make one rope, each strand a man or woman, all pulling in unison for the joy of life well lived. In the name of star, fate, and breath, illuminated by Logos, inspired by the example of the good man, we will not fail in our duties, though the seas roar and mountains shoot flame," he added in a voice barely audible, "and though our own kindred set against us." With a shrug of his shoulder, three fingers rubbing his chin vigorously, he turned to Randall and said, "Set our slates for ship's time. We depart in 15 minutes. The occasional puffs of breeze had finally come to the harbor in greater strength, united as a westerly, blowing steady at 5 to 7 knots. On the sea, Distance and speed here as on Earth were measured in nautical miles and knots, or nautical miles per hour. For Lamarckia, with its radius of 5,931 kilometers, a nautical mile came to about 1,725 meters. I took to the shrouds of the fore and main trees with the least senior apprentices, those who had been aboard the ship a month or less, six in all, and two junior ABs. My group of four set the fore course. Others unfurled the main course and main lower topsail. Then we set the upper topsails and lower topgallants, and three of us, myself included, descended to the deck and forward to bend and raise the outer and inner bellies. With the breeze blowing across the beam, perpendicular to the ship, the captain and mate skillfully ordered us here and there, pulling on this halyard and that, and the ship began to work about, pushing from the dock in gradual zigs and zags. On the dock, wives, children, family, and friends, a fair crowd of about 200, sat waving hands or hats or handkerchiefs, again in somber dignity, with few cheers. However momentous this occasion, however monumental the import of this expedition, the citizens of Calcutta did not reveal their emotions. I remembered wedding or funeral gatherings on Thistledown among Orthodox Naderites, emotion aplenty locked in each breast, but a strong, dedicated face to the world. That restraint had always made me uneasy. As a youngster, dreaming of glory and challenges, I had always wished for a more appreciative farewell from family and friends. The Vigilant sailed with dreamlike smoothness toward the middle of the river. Both port and starboard watches were busy on the deck and in the rigging. The captain stood at the bow, with one foot on the bowsprit, inspecting every meter of the water ahead. I scrambled high up the ratlines, muscles aching, to adjust a jammed block. For a brief moment, I looked across the river and Silva from atop, hands aching, toes and insteps of my feet feeling as if they had been broken. Then, as quickly back down, on deck, dizzy with the height, I pulled on halyards with my team to raise the Christian on the mizzen and secured them to belaying pins. Then we all scrambled aloft again. The waters spread wide in the delta, flowing around dozens of sandy black islands. Beaches sparkled like diamonds against velvet in shafts of light breaking through the thick clouds. Avoiding darker, shifting shallows and gnarls of river vine required more deft maneuvering. After an hour, we saw lines of breakers fighting through thick tangles of vine, an open channel 40 meters deep and 100 wide, and beyond that, blue-gray, and finally slate-gray, the Darwin Sea. As we crossed to brackish and finally ocean water, the air took on a sharp tang. Captain Kaiser Bach remained on the bow, thin nose pointing due west. The breeze had stiffened to 12 knots and we were moving very briskly.
"Shorten sail, Mr. Randall," he instructed. "Take the main courses up 2 points, the fore topgallants 2 points, and let's loose and stow the windscrews for the time being. Steer her northeast by east until we cross the Styx, then due east."
Hanging on to a yard, helping 5 other seamen lift and tie the points on the fore trees' upper topgallant, I felt the touch of a new kind of wind and air, and my skin prickled. The mix of minerals in these waters was not the same as in the Earth's seas, not familiar to my blood. Less sodium salt, more potassium, more dissolved silicates and carbon dioxide and oxygen. Yet, despite the constant faint hiss of oxygen bubbles in the water like a gassy soda, this was undeniably an ocean. Later, as the wind strengthened even more, the captain amended,
"Take in all but main and lower topsails. Once we're out in open sea, we'll set for our best speed and keep well away from shore."
"Yes, sir," Randall responded, and called the apprentices out again. 20 miles and 2.5 hours out of the delta, the foam of oxygen bubbles subsided. Surrounding Lamarckia's continents, and in many huge patches throughout the oceans, microscopic scions of pelagic E. coli dissociated seawater into hydrogen and oxygen. Reducing metabolisms had been chosen here very early in life's history, as on Earth. The routes and processes were substantially different, however. Ahead, spread across our course like thick, straight fingers, 5 tall, dirty brown towers stuck up from the sea, each over 100 meters high. Huge purple and red sails ballooned out from the tops of the towers, light-absorbing tissues, each perhaps a hectare in area. From where I caught a few moments' rest on the top, I saw the towers were shot through with man-high tunnels.
"The sticks! Bunyan's walking sticks," A.B. Shankara said, clinging to the mast. "From Zone 5. The captain will thread them for luck. Then we'll head east."
The ship slipped between the southernmost 2 giants. We watched the waves swell and beat against their immense bases, sucking and booming through the wormhole tunnels. Bulbous black shapes the size of cow's heads poked from some of the narrower tunnels, sporting 3 rows of eyes gleaming in the late afternoon light as the sun flashed beneath a thickening deck of clouds. Shankara had something to say about them, too.
"Sirens!"
he shouted over the flapping of the sails and hum of wind as we hung from a yard, tying reef points.
"They watch all the time, everything. They watch our ships come and go. Spies for their zone. Their bodies!"
I held my breath against a sudden whoop of wind that sang through the braces and forced the sails aback, nearly knocking our boots loose from the foot ropes.
"They twist all through the insides, like worms," he continued. "That's what I'm told. I've never explored the holes."
"You think they're intelligent?"
I yelled back at him.
"Hell no," Shankara said. "They just watch. Who knows what they see?"
"Work! Don't flark!"
the mate shouted from below. 100 miles out of Calcutta, the westerly picked up again, blowing at 15 and then 20 knots, driving strong seas beneath night sky covered with a ceiling of black clouds. We rigged for a steady blow. The dinner was cold for the 5th watch. Leo Frey decided not to risk cooking fires in such a wind or drain the batteries with hot plates. 7 of the starboard watch and I descended to the mess as our watch ended, sitting to eat with stiff fingers our plates of free chunk and fruit, heads drooping in abject exhaustion. With the windscrews stowed and the ship on backup batteries, the electric lights glowed fitfully and in alternation, first 3 on one side, then 3 on the other, as if trading duty. They cast long alternating flickers of brown shadow around us while we tried to eat. With sails properly rigged, a storm watch was called, and the rest of the crew retired to take their dinner as well. Randall stood at a podium forward of the tables and rang a small bell. Heavy heads rose, mouths doggedly chewing, and Randall announced that the captain wished to give a short lecture. The captain took the podium, grabbing it with both hands as a swell lifted and then dropped the ship.
"Each night," he began, "I hope to continue our education on the goals of this journey, to discuss the nature of the Ikoi and their benefits and potential dangers."
Many of the newer members of the crew, myself included, did not yet have their sea legs, or rather their sea lungs. It took some time to get used to the combination of the ship's motion and the invigorating but initially upsetting smell of Lamarckia's sea spray. One by one, cold paste heavy on our stomachs but perhaps not heavy enough, the newer sailors begged the captain's pardon and retreated, either to go topside or to the heads, 2 fore and 1 aft. I counted 6 desertions as the ship pitched and rolled. My own stomach felt none too calm as the seas became rougher. The air was beginning to smell peculiar, like an old orange.
"Yes," the captain said, watching his audience decline. Then, "Yes," again.
And finally he gave it up, postponing the talk until the morning.
"He's a good captain, really," said Algis Bash Shimchisko. "The best on Lamarckia, I bet. A true seaman."
Mishta Ebert went for a second helping of paste and brought it back, grinning as if he'd won a prize.
"He's a very good captain," young Ebert agreed, forking the paste hungrily. "Just enthusiastic. And who's to judge against that?"
I watched him eat and felt my insides quiver.
"Whew," said Shimchisko. "Lost a few this evening, haven't we, Mish?"
"A few," Ebert said.
"No more than I expected." "They'll get right after tomorrow. It's the sea," Shimchisko explained. "Sometimes when even a good sailor spends some time ashore, the smell of the sea, the broad, foaming sea, gets them.
"You all right?" Ebert asked me.
"Never better," I said. I refused to go topside. Once my body had been equipped to handle almost any emergency, any illness, any unease. I was truly on my own now. This naked and natural body, as unfamiliar as somebody else's, a complete stranger's might have been. The days passed in a way I had never experienced before. Time took on a new quality. The ship became a world unto itself. I had difficulty imagining anything else, especially during watches, when one assigned task succeeded another in dizzying succession. Steady, exhausting work day and night, clutching ratlines or hanging onto yards during driving rainstorms and rugged seas, watching foam-ribboned billows as high as the courses on each side. Flat calms when vigilant drifted motionless or slid ahead slowly on a single screw driven by her reserve batteries. Up the shrouds, into the tops and out on the yards, reefing or furling, setting brooms to take advantage of running downwind, bending new sails when the old needed repair, manning winches when the electric motors failed, as they did more often than not. Greasing the trees, the lowest and thickest trees, consisting of three straight legs of a cathedral tree strapped together with thick iron bands, pulling mat fiber strands from great wads of junk and spinning them into twine, drawing the standing rigging taut as it stretched with use, rubbing down the rippled patterns on the Xyla deck with pumice holy stones, raising a faint scent of cloves and garlic, performing the daily ablution of all deck surfaces. Only as I rolled into my bunk, lost in an almost spiritual state of physical exhaustion, did I think of any prior life, of immense chambers within an asteroid, and the dreamlike infinity of the way. None of that seemed real. And yet, I still did not feel firmly established on Lamarckia. It seemed anyone around me, wise old Shankara, nonchalant Ebert, clownish Kisbeg and Ridgel, cynical but intelligent Shimchisko, round-faced Sherla, could tell just by looking at me that I wasn't real. Only the sensual details, minute by minute, gave myself a solidity memory could not corroborate. The invigorating smell of charged air as we sailed the edge of a brewing storm. Towering cumulus clouds swelling into massive anvils over the flat sandy prairies and setback mesas of the Sumner coast, the crimsons and siennas of vivid sunsets over the stern. Under the chafing of ropes and wires, the press of capstan spokes, the palming of marlin spike, my hands became a maze of cuts, scratches, and bruises until they seemed little more than bloody claws. What would have healed in minutes or hours on Thistledown now took days. Still, they toughened, and I no longer flinched from actions that in my inexperience of days before might have caused me painful injury. I dodged, grappled, hung, pulled, shifted, learned when to groan and when to swear. The sun burned bright most days, and I tanned to pale chocolate. The skin on my arms flaked and peeled, and I followed the example of the experienced ABs and smeared my cheeks and arms with thick, milky Lisbu sap scooped from ceramic jugs. To cut the glare, I smeared my lower eyelids with black rouge, the fine powder that fell from all arborite scions in Liz's Silva. My hair dried to a stiff, wiry brush, crusted between infrequent freshwater rinses with a residue of salt spray. Ebert loaned me a pocket mirror. I did not recognize myself. White eyes underscored by black rouge, dark-skinned, brushy-haired. A pirate. I had not spoken much with Randall since being assigned to my berth. After dinner, when weather permitted, the captain told us more about Jittermeier and Baker and Chulago's visit to Martha's Island. Martha's Island differed greatly from most of Elizabeth's land. Volcanic, isolated from other landmasses by 1,000 miles of ocean, a thriving ecos at the center of a sterile sea, it was a perfect site for Kaiserbach's science. Little was known about most of the island, and over a decade had passed since Baker and Chulago's journey. Few ships crossed now between Shea and Elizabeth or Tasman. None had passed Martha's Island since the visit by Baker and Chulago. "We are engaged in primary science," the captain enthused, standing before the lecture board, raising and fastening his sheets of illustrations from Chulago's artists, reproductions of photographs from Baker's cameras. I examined the photographs of Martha's science and Chulago's drawings with a growing bewilderment. Snakes without mouths, arborids that picked up their roots every few days and slunk across the rugged landscape like immense slugs, entire silvas migrating from one side of the island to the other in a few days' time. Hard carapaced guardians rolling on dozens of tough calcareous wheels propelled by vigorous tiny cilia, searching the beaches for intruders, sniffing up humans but paying them little attention. Who could ever make sense of such diversity? The captain sometimes expressed his ideas of ecos organization, of hierarchies, but was reluctant to explain in detail. "All tentative," Kaiserbach said at the end of one lecture, answering questions from the researchers and crew. "We know some things, but not nearly enough." And behind it all, the unproven theory of central queens or seed mothers, perhaps reflecting human needs for answers more than any reality. After a few days, I relaxed completely and let the process of my absorption into the crew become complete. I quickly learned respect for nearly everybody on board, and for the ship itself, which I had underestimated. It gave us few problems at sea, or no more than any ship made of inadequate and primitive materials. Only Shatro, the researcher, continued to leave me unimpressed. Bulky, with large but soft muscles, shorter than me, with a boyish face on a wide head, he was prone to worries and enthusiasms, suspicions and confidences in equal measure. He seldom spoke to me, but I could never tell whether he would treat me with suspicion or say something light and cheerful. He never said anything of much consequence either way. He had a habit of stating the obvious and then being embarrassed about it. I could not yet judge his scientific ability. While at sea, the crew followed the first mate's rules about sex scrupulously, but flirting was rampant, and some couples were beginning to pair off in ways that might as well have involved sex. Men took on women's tasks, and women conferred grooming favors, cutting hair, tending to slight wounds. Some men actually hid their cuts and contusions from Shatro, who acted as ship's doctor, and revealed them to sympathetic female friends in privacy. I learned quickly that many of the women had brought aboard special bags or small trunks containing medicines and sweet or pickled treats, which they doled out to the men they favored. Shirla Apnam, the round-faced A.B., reserved most of her attentions for me, and it would have been out of character, not to say rude, for me to decline. In time, I decided to relax about these matters as well. I was young. My body was in command of its own reactions and not buffered by implants. The flow of time complemented the flow of my hormones, and I realized with some surprise that socializing was a bodily function, regulated by deep instincts. Aboard Thistledown, most of us, and nearly all in the Geshel communities, had acquired so many layers of conscious control and supplemental intervention that it seemed, from my new perspective, we might have lost sight of our true animal natures. And that, of course, had been the point. We had risen above our instincts and the rough grind of history. We had given human society a new and smoother character. The immigrants had both the best and the worst of their own unenhanced natures. At first, I found Shirla attractive, but not deeply so. I would as soon have had the attentions of one or two of the other women, but did not encourage them. Shirla was pleasant, however, and her conversation interesting enough. She did not seem to take our flirtation with deep seriousness, so we avoided private admonishments from Talia Rydiam, who regarded it as her duty to keep the younger women from being hurt, as apparently she had been years before by shipboard trysts, even unconsummated ones. For the ship was small enough, and the mate rat-nosed enough that sneaking off in privacy for anything more was almost impossible. Randall and the first mate often deferred male-female disciplinary problems to Rydiam, and partly through her vigilance the mate did not have to follow through on his muttered threats to put various over-demonstrative couples into compartments in the bilge. To my surprise, Rydiem took Kisbeg and Ridgel directly in hand. Soterio was glad to leave the two problem children to her half-tender mercies. Rydiem, Sonia Chung, Seima Ap Monash, and the other women ABs gave the crew its final social structure, that of an extended family, with Rydiem as surrogate mother, and finally Shankara and Meisner as surrogate fathers. The captain became a tough taskmaster, combination peculiar god and professor, and more than once did I hear Rydiem threaten Kisbeg with a tree hearing, being called up before Kaiser Bach for whatever infractions had most recently occurred. Kisbeg always relented. We traveled for 3 days in the sea-chopping westerly, then turned south-southeast, coming within a mile of the eastern Sumner coast, though still sailing in deep water. So little of the coast had been explored or named that 1,000 miles of it, filled with shallow bays and backed by deserts and hills, carried only one designation, Sumner, after Lenk's second economist, Abba Sumner, who had also laid out Calcutta. The currents flowed dark and rich beneath the Vigilant, and in what little time I had to spare, I stood by the rail peering into the clear water. Kaiser Bach had finally gotten the crew used to a nightly round of lectures, and most recently we had discussed Zone 5 pelagic science. I saw them swimming close to the surface, massive piscates called eggplant sharks, 10 to 15 meters long, deep purple-blue with white spots, thick-bodied and trilaterally symmetric, with blunt mouthless noses and lines of knife-shaped bony fins sweeping from nose to screw-like tails. They spun slowly in the water as they glided beneath the Vigilant. We also saw bowfish like gigantic tide ribbons floating on a gift-wrapped sea, long red streamers trailing from their wing-like fins 15 or 20 meters behind. Tangled masses of arm-thick vine seemed substantial as rope, yet parted like soap suds as the ship passed through them, and regrouped in our wake. A storm inland had broken loose balloon trees, close relatives of Lisbu, according to Randall. On the third day, the gas bag of one floated off the starboard beam, twisting slowly, rumpled and half-deflated in the currents. As I watched, coiling ropes and splicing a broken line with a marlin spike, piscids the size and rough shape of harbor seals, but black and silver in color, tore at the balloon vigorously with external fangs, called thorn teeth by the captain, then sucked the shredded fragments into orifices along their sides. Getting a closer look at one near the ship, I saw no head or mouth as such, only broad paddle-shaped fins with sharp white claws, and in a line on each side, the little mouth-like openings with sky-blue interior tissues revealed. They swam swiftly both backward and forward with rapid swishes, reversing their fins. Some, Shimchisko and Ebert among them, believed the cucumber sharks and other large piscids would eat anything tossed into the water. Shankara believed they acted more as cleanup crews, and did not actually digest the fragments they swallowed, but carried them to special stations where they were processed. According to the captain, predation between Ikoi was rare between Elizabeth's Land and Petain, or at least quite formalized. They watch, they spy constantly, sending thieves or samplers, usually in the air but also underground, or skimming across the river or ocean. Between zones, the boundaries are clearly marked, but on rare occasion, parties of mobile scions will cross in a tight herd, grab what they can of arborids or phytids, and return. We do not know why. Perhaps the zones need to challenge each other. Perhaps it is a kind of sport. Sherla equated it with love bites, but I could not tell if she was serious. 6. As evening approached and my watch ended, with the day's work done and the ship rigged to slice on a beam reach across the strengthening northerlies, I leaned on the starboard rail amidships and studied the shore from our distance of 5 nautical miles. The high cliffs of this part of the eastern Sumner coast were split with deep U-shaped grooves that spilled boulder-strewn floors into the sea, then thrust sinuously inland. I judged glaciers had once cut these grooves. A scattering of rangy short arborids covered the mesas and plains, and between them a velvety, patchy carpet of blue and brown phytids spread in gentle mounds like fuzz on a rotting peach. The sun had reached its vernal zenith 4 hours before, and now fled steadily westward, gently warming my face and hands, brightening the cloudless skies to a chalky enamel blue, almost white above Elizabeth's Land. The air smelled round and sweet, unlike any air I had ever breathed before, and the ocean sang its liquid rhythms against the hull, a metronomic slap of waves and hissing trill of swirling waters. Our wake fell astern in steady, white, smeared curves, with a shiny, roiling smoothness between, vanishing when the ship had advanced a few miles. Randall strolled beside me and leaned on the rail, in a mood to talk.
"We've been at sea a week," he said. "The mate and I have kept our eyes on you."
I nodded, unsure what to say.
"You told me you'd catch on fast, and you have. I'd swear you've sailed before."
"I've dreamed of sailing all my life," I said.
"You're the best apprentice on board, better than Shimchisko even, and he's a decent fellow, though he does have a sharp tongue. You could go for your A-B rate in short order if you wanted. I also notice you attend the captain's lectures, no matter how tired you are.
They're fascinating."
"Yes, well, he's a fine captain, but maybe the best scientist on Lamarckia, or a close tie with Mansur Salop. We've traveled Tasman and Elizabeth and the Coop Islands together for 10 years now, at sea and ashore."
He let silence sit between us for several minutes, the sweet wind providing enough distraction.
"It's your face that interests me, Sir Olmi. The apprentices, the ABs, they're familiar faces to me. I know their types. I have to judge people, and I think I'm good at it. But I cannot, by face or breath or fate, judge you."
He looked at me directly, elbows on the rail, hands clasped.
"I swear you're older than you look, and no more than you say."
I raised my eyebrows to acknowledge these unwanted observations. First Larissa, then Thomas, now Randall. I seemed particularly transparent to these people.
"How do you feel you fit in with the crew?" he asked.
"Sir?"
"You don't scuffle, you don't argue, and you certainly don't aspire to a sailor's top bunk. You're calm and humble, Sir Olmi."
"Thank you, sir," I said. "I've made friends and taken advice. Listening makes me popular, I suppose."
He laughed. "But you're hiding something."
"Sir?"
"I suppose having your family proscribed does something to your spirit. 2 years in the heart of Liz, witness to atrocity."
He shook his head, then clucked his tongue in sympathy.
"No easy way to return to the bosom of society. What I'm coming round to, Sir Olmi, is that when we put into Jakarta and Wallace Station and pick up Mansur Salop and our researchers, there will be a lot of work that requires more than a sailor's skills. We are short of trainable assistants with sharp eyes and sharp minds. From the moment we picked up the children above Calcutta, you've impressed me. I'll watch you the next few days. Don't let it make you nervous. And after we pass through Jakarta, I'll consider suggesting that you become an assistant to the researchers. I think we understand each other."
He nodded as if greeting the coast and said, "I love this stretch. So different from the Silva around Calcutta."
As the starboard watch ended, Shirla and Talia Rydiam called together a circle of apprentices and ABs. Shirla took my elbow and pulled me into the circle, and Meissner brought out 2 long-stringed instruments, each with 2 parallel rows of 4 strings suspended above 2 adjacent resonating hemispheres made from dried phytid fruit. These were kimbors, developed by the immigrants in the first few years after the crossing. Meissner handed one to Rydiam and began to tune one himself. Rydiam hummed and sang a sequence of clear notes on a pentatonic scale, and all around the circle others joined in, tuning themselves to the instruments and Rydiam. Their voices seemed to cut through the wind. Shirla put a Xyla shoe on one bare foot, took Rydiam's kimbor, set up a steady beat on the deck with the toe of the shoe, and thumbed the lower bowl with her fingers. Immediately the crew in the circle began a high, singing chant. Meissner provided a booming bass line, sounding like a talented bullfrog. Shimchisko stood with hands outstretched and began a falsetto vocal. The hair on my neck stood up. I'd never heard anything like this. It sounded primeval, but very complex. I had no idea the Lamarckian immigrants had developed such a different style of music. Shimchisko sang a list of names, starting with the people in the circle, then growing more and more exotic until they became nonsense words. Others picked up with words that pleased them, and soon 12 voices wove in and out around each other, until the whole became far too complicated. The song collapsed in laughter, and Shirla thumped the deck rapidly 5 times with her shoe. Next came a quiet ballad, sung by Shirla and Meissner, in clear words describing the sweet romance between a young lad and the personified Queen of Elizabeth's Zone. This was an old song, apparently, and its sentiment struck Shimchisko and several others deeply. Meissner's eyes filled with tears as Shirla described the inevitable end of the Queen's love and the suicide of the boy, who leaped from a cliff into the depths of an unknown silver. The singing went on for 2 hours, punctuated by sips from a jug of matte fiber beer. Randall joined in toward the last, singing a song his mother had taught him, about children naming the scions they met in a newly settled silver. His voice was gravelly but well modulated. They all sang well. The evening ended with Leo Frey serving small sweet cakes. Kaiser Bach came down from the pupus, and Guzmao, the reclusive carpenter, joined us also, which brought a toast from Sotero to the craft rates. A.B.'s toasted the captain and master, and Randall offered a toast to the apprentices. Just growing in the ways of Lamarckia's seas. Kisbeg, in turn, toasted Talia Rydiam, who cracked my head early and gives this ship spirit. Rydiam actually blushed. The stars came out from behind thin clouds. Head filled with the music, I rolled into my bunk. The ship sailed around a barren, wind-whipped promontory called Cape Sadness. 5 ships had been wrecked here, I heard from Shimchisko. The captain surveyed the cape with a telescope, looking for scion activity. The winds and sea were favorable this day, and we rounded the cape without incident.